I believe there is a universal filter, a universal story that we are all seeking to understand. And I call it the red thread. It's a phrase borrowed from Scandinavian countries where they use it to say, what is the thing that ties all this together? What's the theme? What's the message? What's the through line? And we all want that. And in fact, what I've discovered is that we all have that. So every organization, every person, every idea has this thing that makes it make sense. But how we make it make sense is fascinating to me. So the best way to think about it is as Mad Libs. Remember that game where these pre-written stories, but they have holes in them? And when we are trying to make sense of a situation, or we're trying to make sense of what someone's asking us to do, or if we're in the position that I was in so often of how do I tell this story in such a way that moves people, the pattern of that story, that's universal. And like a pre-written Mad Lib story. But where it becomes unique and where the power is, not only for us to understand what our own red thread is, but as we're trying to explain other things to other people, is that what that leaves us to do is we don't have to figure out the whole story. All we have to do is figure out how do we fill in the blanks.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Before we start, I just want to share two quick things with you. If you have guest recommendations or stories that you think we should know about, shoot us an email at hello@unmistakablemedia.com. We love hearing from our listeners. And if you're looking for a keynote speaker for your event or want to bring our team at Unmistakable Creative to your event or organization for a workshop on creativity and productivity, visit unmistakablecreative.com/speaking, send us the details, and we'll be in touch. And as always, today's episode is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. Whether you're looking to start a new website or move an existing one, HostGator can help. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy, and if you want to move from an existing host to HostGator, they make it free and super simple. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Tamsin, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
I am so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is really cool to have you here. You know, I came across your story by way of our mutual friend, Clay Hebert, and then I had the opportunity to connect with you when I was preparing for my TEDx talk and was really kind of blown away by everything that you had done. But before we get into all of that, I want to start with a question based on having read your about page, which, by the way, is one of the coolest about pages that I've ever seen.
Thank you so much.
And so I want to start by asking, what birth order were you and what impact did that end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
I would love to ask you, like, which one do you think I was? I was the younger sister.
Okay.
I was number two. And I think it had an impact on me in quite a number of ways. My sister's 4 years older. She's a screenwriter in LA. And the distance between us was just enough for us to almost cross paths. And it became worse at a certain point because I skipped first grade. I went from kindergarten to second grade, which meant that where once upon a time, I'm sure my parents had this blissful idea that we'd never be in the same school at the same time. All of a sudden I'd screwed up that plan. And when she was a senior, I was a freshman and all sorts of fun things ensued. Mostly though, I think what that did was it made it really clear, and I don't know that we fell into this consciously or not, that there were certain things that were her domain and there were certain things that were mine. So we were both really interested in the arts, but she was the dramatist. You know, as you can see now, she's a screenwriter, so she stuck with it. But I was the singer and she was the writer and I was the visual artist. And what was interesting about that is that for much of my life, I figured that was it, that she was the one who was the talented writer. She was the storyteller. She was all of these things because it was the easiest way to avoid conflict in the house, not because we were a very conflict ready house. It just happened that way. But it's been interesting over my your more adult life to start to see. I mean, the funniest discovery I made was to go back and look at my visual art from high school and realize it was complete crap. I mean, it was, I mean, I am really not talented when it comes to visual art, and yet I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. And I went back and read some of my writing from high school, and I was like, oh, that was actually pretty good. And you know what's funny is that these days my sister and I are fascinated by the fact that she and I do two sides of a very similar thing. And so even though we had this original thing where we split our domains, like, you know, you do this, I do this, and never the twain shall meet, what she and I both do now is figure out how to tell powerful stories in a very short period of time. You know, my domain is business speaking and TED Talks, and hers is TV. So she's a TV screenwriter. She's worked on a couple features as well. But for both of us, we're talking about somewhere between 20 minutes for a half an hour show in her case and a TED Talk in mine, to all the way up to 90 minutes to 2 hours. So a feature length movie for her and a keynote length, you know, an extended keynote talk or workshop for me. And who knows where that came from, but we're still kind of finding our own domain, but around the same type of thing.
Wow. Okay. So many questions come from that. you know, so you seem to have been raised by parents who encourage sort of blazing unconventional trails, just based on sort of what you've told me so far. So having had that been the case, I'm curious what you would tell parents who are listening to the show who have young kids, who are sort of in this evolutionary and growth phase of their lives.
Well, you're right that my parents were incredible models for unconventional paths. A lot of that is because my father was in the Navy, which may not be unconventional in and of itself, but my father is a deeply pacifistic man. And he was a submariner. And so he went to Vietnam, but he was in the water off of Vietnam. So it's just always took very interesting ways. But for him, the Navy was his path to go to Stanford, where he went and where he met my mother, who also went to Stanford. And she came from quite a rural area north of Seattle, the Skagit Valley in Washington State. But my mother got a PhD in 1976. So think about that. So she comes from a rural town, incredibly poor upbringing, goes to Stanford, gets a PhD in anthropology, where, interestingly enough, she was studying what's called the return and reunion phenomenon of Navy families. What happens to the relationships when in that case, at that time, mostly men leave and you've got a woman, the mother, taking care of everything, being mom and dad, running the household, making all these decisions. And then all of a sudden dad comes back, dad, like, I'm still the dad. And then how do those roles continue to shift? So just her was an incredible model from that standpoint. The thing that each of them, though, have still in common, and that they encouraged in both my sister and me, was that there were only the barriers that you thought you saw. Like, the only barriers that existed were the ones you chose to see. And that was incredible, because there was really nothing that they ever said no to. When we said, well, I want to try this, they said, okay. I want to try this, okay. And that even extended to how we went, you know, how they helped us think about college. Their deal was for us that we could go anywhere, that they would do whatever they needed to from a financial standpoint for us to go anywhere we wanted. So my sister, back to the theme of my sister goes to Stanford. So now there's three people in my immediate family who go to Stanford. So of course I'm like, I'm totally not going to Stanford. Refused to even apply. And I ended up at Boston University because I wanted to be in a city. But what was interesting about that was, from there, they said, we can do anything that you want for undergraduate or graduate school. That's completely up to you. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, both my sister and I went on to graduate degrees, and both of them both for both of us, they continue to be quite exploratory. But it really did come down to this, why not kind of perspective that they had, which is interesting because in certain ways, my parents are also in certain ways very cautious, but in other ways, they're really quite not. And I have to give them credit for that because they just came back from a trip to Laos and the Mekong River. So, which they consider a vacation and I would consider penitence for something, not from the location, but the fact that they just really enjoy hard trips like that. And I am made of much less stern stuff.
You know, that sense that the only obstacles that exist are the ones that you see or the ones that you make up. I am curious how you develop that because like I can understand that intellectually. But then, you know, I wonder at moments if I can, you know, why I struggle to apply something like that in my life.
You know, they are both very questioning folks. So back to your question from before about what would I say to parents, and it's something I try to do with my own children, is they always sought to understand. So they would ask questions. So if I didn't do well on something, they would ask questions like, did you do as well as you wanted to? And I would have to answer that question. Did you think you were capable of more? Is that the best way that you saw to do it? What other way would be appropriate? Have you thought about X? And it was very much always, we were both encouraged from my recollection to always be thoughtful about how we were thinking. And that has been, I would say, their greatest gift to me because, I mean, it did various points in my life careen over into neuroticism. I've pulled myself back from that edge. But the encouragement to always be thoughtful about why you think the way that you do was incredibly helpful for revealing assumptions and revealing those blocks and biases and logical loopholes that we're often not conscious of. And my parents were really good about questioning things. And that's what has persisted. And so to take that to present day and say, how could somebody else think about how do you overcome the barriers that you think you see is to pull back and say, how am I defining this barrier? Where did it come from? What are alternate explanations for this barrier that I see being in place? In other words, how can I disconfirm what I believe to be true? And that ends up being a mantra that I use quite often for myself is disconfirm what you believe to be true. Because only when you've eliminated all the other things, then can you say, all right, now I think I'm looking at something fairly and accurately. And that willingness to be doubtful in being right it has been useful. Do I always succeed at it? Hell no. But there was, you know, one of the pieces of advice I would give to younger folks that worked for me and back in the days where I was managing people, teams of people, was to say act as if you're wrong even when you know you're right, because that will keep your brain open to the fact that you may not in fact be right. So I think it all comes down to questions because questions help you reveal assumptions about the truth.
Hmm. Wow. So walk me through sort of the trajectory from, you know, this childhood of yours that clearly has been very interesting to how you ended up doing the work that you do today. Like, how did you end up here at this point? What have been the significant inflection points?
Oh, Lord. I think actually the work that I do now has been one massive attempt to justify what has otherwise been a fairly circuitous path.
I can relate.
So, So Navy family, we moved 5 times before I was 5. That had a lot to do, I think, with self-sufficiency. Anybody that I know that grew up in a military family has an extraordinary sense of independence and self-sufficiency, and an ability to figure out how to connect quickly with whatever and wherever you might be or find yourself at the time. It was still at the same time, as I've mentioned, a very artistic upbringing. And so while I was very much involved in the arts, my opportunity, when it came time to choose where to go to college, what I wanted to study, it was in the late 80s, early 90s, which was not a great time economically. And, you know, in my know-it-all teenage years, I was like, I can't believe my sister went to Stanford for a theater degree. And, you know, I was like, I'm going to do something really, really practical. And I am going to get a degree in business, because that way I can always be employed. And so that's what I did. I was like, I'm going to study business, but I'm going to study marketing, because that was, for me, I considered it to be the most creative option out there. And I also considered it the path through which, if I were employed and I had the sensitivity to creatives, that one of the things that I would often say is that I wanted to be in a position where I could make it easier for other people to do what it is that they love to do. And that realization came from the fact that, you know, I had this choice about whether or not to pursue the arts, because I sang and I acted. And I just realized I didn't have the fire for it. And I was in school with people who clearly did, who were and are working actors on Broadway and on TV, who make their living as concert singers and such. And I was just like, I just don't have that. But I know it's going to be a really hard life. So what can I do to make it easier? So I decided I wanted to be a museum director because of course, right? That's what everybody wants to grow up and be. And what I discovered was, after the first year of college, I hated business school, like despised it. I was all ready to quit after the first year and go to NYU and go back to the arts. And I had a college counselor, an advisor, who very kindly said to me, I think you're just bored. And I said, I think you're right. And so she introduced me to the fact that BU had this other program that they have there, called what they call the collaborative degree program. And that allowed me to actually get 2 degrees at the same time. So over 4 years at Boston University, I was able to get 2 degrees. And so what I was able to do was add something in that satisfied that art piece for me. So I went into American studies. I got an art history minor because I was still thinking I want to be a museum director. And then when it came time to graduate, it was still not great financially at that point. And so I was like, well, let's just stay in school. And so I got my MBA, when I was 23. So I went straight into business school from undergrad, which was unusual in and of itself. Because I found a program that would allow me to kind of combine both this practical and creative side as a grad school program too. So I found this program at Southern Methodist University, that's the arts administration program, where I could get a master's degree in arts administration at the same time I was getting an MBA. So here I go, outspoken, short, you know, short-haired, liberal New Englander, like, goes to Dallas. Hilarity ensues because Dallas and I don't really get along. Like, the whole city and I don't really get along. But it was a wonderful experience because it helped give me a different perspective. I consciously went to a different area from where I grew up. I grew up in Virginia Beach, and I wanted to go to New England because I wanted to experience that. And then when I decided to go to grad school, I wanted something really different. I wanted to get a different perspective from somewhere else. And Dallas was definitely that. And what happened when I was in Dallas, so I know this is a big old run up to everything, but what happened when I was in Dallas was I got a job working, well, wait, first, the job that I was doing for pocket money was working at Banana Republic. So yeah, whatever. But in addition to that, I got a job working at a consulting company, which was my first experience in getting completely led off track by a big paycheck. And because they pay people just a stupid amount of money to be a consultant coming out of business school. And so I was doing that part time. And when I graduated, I was like, oh, well, let me just make all my money up front and then I can help the artist later. And so I went into management consulting for a year and a half. And in that time, I had a performance review where I was told, and I wish this weren't true. I was told to do my hair and wear more lipstick. The work was fine. But, you know, the hair and the lipstick were not so fine. So it was at that point where I'm like, ah, to hell with it. There's not enough money in the world to make this okay. And so I took a 50% pay cut. I got myself back to Boston and I started working for a museum, which is this crazy museum up in Salem, Massachusetts, called the Peabody Essex Museum. The oldest continuously operating museum in the United States, actually. And so I worked there, and my job there was actually really useful because it did combine this art business thing that I had been studying now for 6 years. So my job there was to serve as the liaison between the marketing departments and the fundraising department. And eventually that morphed into being the head of their exhibition planning, mostly because I was annoyed that we couldn't market these shows, these exhibits that were coming up, because we didn't know what they were. And so eventually, apparently I barked enough about that. They're like, you, fine, fix it. I was like, okay. So I did. And so I worked there for a number of years doing that. And then after that, when I decided, okay, I want to do something a little bit different. I'm not sure what I want to do. I don't think I want to do exhibitions the whole time. I had an opportunity to become the director of marketing communications at a local performing arts college called the Boston Conservatory. And it's one of very few institutions that combines music, dance, and theater. So I was like, yay, I get to like do all the other arts that I did before. And my job for them was really to help them identify them for themselves why people would want to get coming there. And that was a challenge because in Boston, there are two conservatories, just to be very confusing. There's the Boston Conservatory, which nobody knew about, and there was the New England Conservatory, which is what most people think of. But there's also Berklee College of Music. There's also a couple other independent music schools, and then there are all the music departments of all the colleges that are in the Boston area, which is some number that exceeds 100. And so my goal leaving the Boston Conservatory was, I just want people, when I say I work at the Boston Conservatory, instead of saying the New England Conservatory, to say, oh, which one is that again? Like, that was my goal. So I worked there for 4.5 years. It was a great place. And I feel like it was, you know, between that and the Peabody Essex Museum, you know, I could start to see this thread that I now see in all my work, which is I was always trying to figure out, what was the core of that institution, or in the case of the Peabody Essex Museum, the core of what aspects of the collection or a particular show were most powerful, that held the greatest energy, that held the greatest potential for connecting with who those organizations were there to serve? So with the Peabody Essex Museum, it's about figuring out how do you own the fact that this is a crazy mishmash of a collection, but it's awesome. And it was a time where this museum, this regional museum north of Boston, wanted to be, you know, the Museum of Fine Arts, you know, so think of Boston's equivalent to the Metropolitan Museum in New York. They wanted to be that on the North Shore, but they never are, because, I mean, if you have an association with Salem, Massachusetts, and just about everybody does, you know, like if I say Salem, Massachusetts, is there something that pops into mind?
For most people, witch trials.
You got it. It's the witches. So Salem like owns its witches, man. I mean, there are like there's a statue, a horrible one, by the way, of Samantha from Bewitched. You know, there's like 18 witch museums. And to confuse it even further, the Peabody Esque Museum has all of the historical trial documents from the Salem witch trials. But you know, there was a time where the museum really wanted to suppress that because they wanted to be the MFA of the North Shore. But really, once they started to rotate around this idea of we have a story, we have this crazy collection, and it is different and meaningful to people, not only from here, but for people who want to come to New England and experience everything that New England has been, there's honestly no better place than this crazy mishmash of a collection at the Peabody Essex Museum, because it is that. It's exactly that. And the same thing was true with the Boston Conservatory. So I often will tell this story about when I first worked there. One of my responsibilities while I was there was to do all the admissions materials. So the materials that students would ask for and get to decide they wanted to come here, to come to the conservatory. And the view book, which is the main printed piece at the time that did that, there was this picture of a theater on the cover, the inside of a theater. Now that makes sense. It's a performing arts college. You want people to be like, oh yeah, I want to be on stage. But there was a problem with this picture. The picture was not from the conservatory's theater. That theater didn't belong to the Boston Conservatory. So people would come and they'd be like, well, where's that theater? You know, after seeing our like pretty sketch, like built in 1942, wooden seat, chip stuff, like cinder block walls. And they'd be like, where's the one on the picture? And we'd be like, it's not there. So the first thing I did was like, well, let's figure out what do we need to do here that people actually want? And what I ended up doing was saying, well, actually what I did was I asked people like, why would you do that? Why did someone make this decision to put some other theater on the cover? And they said, well, because our theater isn't very nice. I was like, okay, but it is the theater that you have. They said, yeah, but it's expensive to come here and we don't want people to get scared off at the front. And I'm like, but all right, let's think about this. Think about you're a parent and you've got a kid that wants to be a dancer or an orchestral musician or a musical theater actor so much that they're willing to do only that for 4 years. As a parent, what is your chief concern? Like, how is this child going to pay the bills, right? Mm-hmm. How do I, like, I've got an option to send this kid to like a liberal arts school or a very specialized performing arts college. What's my concern? Is this kid going to be able to work? So what I started to say was, well, what was interesting, the important thing to know is that the alumni of the Boston Conservatory are everywhere and they are successful working musicians. They are, the ones you've heard of, you can smile and laugh a little bit, but like Constantine Maroulis, who like nearly won American Idol, and then Cat McPhee, who also did, and other folks, but people that you would see on Broadway and know, came from the Boston Conservatory. So we had a history of working folks. And the point I made was, listen, if this is the result that these kids can work, even when our theater looks like that, or there are poles in the middle of our dance studios, which there were, and they can still be successful, what do you think prepares your kids, prospective parents of these kids, better? A pristine, protected environment, or one that mimics now the conditions that they're most likely to face when they go out into the world? And so we repositioned everything around this idea of this is for working. Our goal is to create working students and to create the resilience and the resourcefulness and to develop and nurture that talent for your kids to be able to work. And that ended up being remarkably successful. And by the way, it ended up being a good baseline for that, for which to raise money too, because you're like, but now imagine how much even better it would be if they didn't have to dance around poles, and not the stripper pole kind. I mean, like literally like support beam pole. So from there, kind of taking those lessons, I was like, well, maybe I've got something here in figuring out how to make people understand a fairly complicated, kind of a challenging idea. At the time too, I was trying to decide, well, do I want to go out on my own? Do I want to do more in, you know, this what's called institutional advancement in nonprofits, the blend of marketing development? And I said, well, let's learn how to raise money a bit better. And so I got a job working at Harvard Medical School, which this is one of the first places where it's like, okay, museum made sense, Boston Conservatory made sense, medical school does not make sense. But it does make sense in the case that I was really interested at that point about how do you help bridge the gap between something that needs to happen, raise money so that we can solve some of the most pressing issues of science and health that are out there, and what is currently happening, which is people don't understand why they would possibly need to give money to Harvard, which has enough money to make it equivalent to the 18th largest country in the world. And so I took that challenge on for 3 years, which is how do I explain the work of the medical school? How do I explain basic science? And what I mean by basic science is the thing that happens and has to happen before you can figure out the cure for things. It's the thing that says, why does this molecule behave this way? It's the thing that says, why don't we know this thing yet? And these scientists do it without knowing what the answer is. And so at medical school, that was my job, was to figure out why would people give and why did the scientists do their work, and to create the gap between that and to bridge the gap between that. And that's the first place I started to notice that there were patterns to those connections, that it ended up being much more powerful to talk to our donors or the equivalent of our market based on why they gave rather than on how much they gave. And this started to lay in this idea for me that mindset is way more important than any market as we might typically think of it. Because the person who gives money to Harvard Medical School, who is baffled by these unanswered questions about science and about why don't we know why certain diseases happen, if they give money at the $20 level, they have much more in common with somebody who is also interested in that question but gives $20 million than two $20 million donors have in common with each other. And so I really want to start figuring out what's going on there. So after the medical school, I said, I want to see how this pattern manifests across more kinds of institutions. So I became a brand strategist for 3 years at a wonderful firm here in Boston called Samets Blackstone Associates that focuses primarily on arts and cultural institutions and nonprofits. And so I was able to see that and see how that pattern developed over time and understand how do you find that core of a message at a high level. At the same time, this is now 2009, so this is when social started to hit. And so I took that on as a challenge and figured out, well, how do we take this big message and use these social channels to promote it? In other words, how do I take this big message and make it day-to-day? And a few years after I'd figured out what I wanted to figure out there, then I moved to an advertising agency where I built out the social and digital content practice for for-profit clients. Because now I figured, I'm like, okay, I got the whole nonprofit thing. How is it different for for-profit? And I was like, you know what? It's not that different. But what I was realizing that, you know, now that I had this idea, I'm like, okay, I have a sense of how to find what's powerful about an organization or an idea. I have a sense of how to connect that to what people are interested in from, you know, what, you know, who we want to benefit from that idea. I have a sense now of how to articulate that idea at both a high level and at a detailed level. I know it for nonprofits. I want to understand it for for-profit institutions. And so at the agency, Allen and Gerritsen, that's what I was doing. I built out their social and digital content practice and found that missing in all of that was this thing that happened in between, which was how do you bridge between what we want people to know and what they do know? And ultimately, what I found the answer to that came in something I had been doing all along in parallel to all of these jobs, which was I was a Weight Watchers leader. Didn't see that coming. But 18 years ago now, I weighed 50 pounds more than I do, and I started to become a Weight Watchers leader. And so what that did for me was it took everything that I was taught theoretically in school that was that applied at a market level in all those jobs, and it gave me a lab to test how does it actually work, though, one-on-one with people. Because my job as a Weight Watchers leader was for 30 minutes at a time, up to 5 times a week, for 13 years, my job was to figure out how do I convince this group of people to do something that's hard and difficult, but helps them get something that they want. And so eventually I kept focusing down, and then I realized the thing I most love to do was around that one-on-one that got one to many. And yeah, I had the opportunity to become the executive producer of TEDx Cambridge 3.5 years ago, grabbed at that and started to find that the most powerful things that I could offer were the lessons I learned at Weight Watchers, informed by the market sensibility of everything else I'd done. And that's the really long version of the story.
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So maybe you have a creative project that you want to start and you have no idea where to get started or can't figure out even what the first step is. And I always say one of the easiest first steps is to just buy a domain name or to start building a website. It doesn't even have to be a complicated website. It can just be a picture and a bio about you. And fortunately, our friends at HostGator are fantastic for helping you to get started. They have an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy. They have 24/7 live support via phone chat and email. And if you have an existing website that you want to move to HostGator, they make it free and super simple. And they're offering 30% off all of their hosting packages for Unmistakable Creative listeners. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. And if you're looking for a speaker for your event or organization, or you want to bring the Unmistakable Creative team to your event or company for a workshop on creativity and productivity, just visit UnmistakableCreative.com/speaking, fill out the form, and we'll get back to you. Okay, so I want to spend the remainder of our time, which we have about 20 minutes, talking about something that you said at the very beginning of the conversation, which kind of, I think, ties this all together. You know, we've looked at it at a very micro level, and I want to take it back and look at it at a macro level. You said a phrase, telling powerful stories in a short amount of time, which, you know, in my mind is probably what the title of the interview is going to be. So I'm curious if we could look at sort of a framework for how that actually happens in our own lives and in our own work.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So the summation of all of that stuff was my reverse engineering off of what I had seen to find that there, in fact, I believe there is a universal filter, a universal story that we are all seeking to understand. And I call it the red thread. It's a phrase borrowed from Scandinavian countries where they use it to say, what is the thing that ties all this together? What's the theme? What's the message? What's the through line? And we all want that. And in fact, what I've discovered is that we all have that. So every organization, every person, every idea has this thing that makes it make sense. But how we make it make sense is fascinating to me. So the best way to think about it as Mad Libs. Remember that game where these pre-written stories, but they have holes in them? And when we are trying to make sense of a situation, or we're trying to make sense of what someone's asking us to do, or if we're in the position that I was in so often of how do I tell this story in such a way that moves people, the pattern of that story, that's universal. And like a pre-written Mad Lib story. But where it becomes unique and where the power is, not only for us to understand what our own red thread is, but as we're trying to explain other things to other people, is that what that leaves us to do is we don't have to figure out the whole story. All we have to do is figure out how do we fill in the blanks? How do we personally fill in the blanks? Now, the core of this red thread revolves around three things, and they are, two of them are expected and one of them is not. I think the first thing is, what is the thing that I want you to do differently? You know, And if I'm in a marketing position, or if I'm trying to tell a story, like this is kind of like, here's the thing that I want you to have, you know, to change your opinion where afterwards. So, you know, Boston Conservatory, I want you to send your kids here. Harvard Medical School, give us money. That's great, except that on its own, that's not enough, because anybody who has ever been hard sold anything knows that it doesn't matter how great your solution might be. If I don't understand why I need it, then it's not going to be useful. So the first piece is that solution. The second piece is the why you need it, which is the problem. And that's, again, not rocket science. But the thing that I figured out by looking and working with people and trying to tell these stories in a short amount of time so often was that the thing that was missing between – that there was something missing between the two. And the thing that was missing between the two was, for lack of any better word, an idea. And here's what I mean by that. The example I'll often give is, you know, so if you walk into a doctor's office and your doctor, as soon as you walk in, says, so, hey, when do you want to schedule surgery? Like, that's the equivalent of only presenting the solution to something, right? So we need the other questions answered. So even if she or he says, you have a spot on your back, you need surgery. Aha, you still have a question. What kind of spot? Why is surgery the right answer? And that missing link was the thing I got obsessed with starting to figure out. And so this idea is this thing that simultaneously explains why the problem is such a problem and why the solution that you're recommending is a solution that's required. And so this trio of problem, idea, change is enormously powerful. And it sits at the core, if I'm working with people on how to build a talk around that, then there's a couple extra things. You have to identify the goal that the problem is in the way of, and oftentimes you have to describe what the actions are that make the change. But this idea of problem, idea, change, symptom, diagnosis, solution is the core of everything. And so if you're a person, you're like, well, what's my red thread? The way that I suggest people do this is to think to yourself, identify each of those three things. Identify yourself, what are the problems that I'm drawn to solve? So for me, I solve problems about energy being misdirected or misapplied, right? So if I go back and I look at all the things that I did, I was always looking for where's the potential power here? And why is there a gap between what I can clearly see in something is great and why is it not happening? Then the second question to ask yourself is, what is the idea? What is the reason why I think that idea is such a problem? And this for a person is going to come down to, what are your core values and beliefs? What are the core realizations that you have? And for me, that's a couple. One is that I believe everybody already has everything that they need. It actually comes from a Weight Watcher tenet, which was, you have all the resources that you need. And then add to that a fascinating piece of science that I got from one of my clients once upon a time, who was, of all things, an electric equipment manufacturer, who said, hey, Tamsin, do you know the difference between energy and power? And he, of course, was talking about the electrical engineering differences between energy and power. But as soon as he said that, I'm like, okay, those are two of my favorite words. Tell me more. He said, power is energy sustained over time. And I said, that's it. Like that. That is that. If I had to say one thing that summarized my entire belief system, is that power comes from sustaining energy over time. Which means that if I now ask the third question, which is, what is the skill set? What are the approaches that I always bring to bear? It explains why I'm obsessed with frameworks. I'm obsessed with processes. I'm obsessed with models. Because if I can think about better ways to think, see, this goes all the way back to what my parents taught me, then I can get to that power more quickly without wasting energy, and I can accomplish all the things that I want or need to accomplish, or I can help someone else do that. So those three things, what are the problems I'm drawn to solve? What are the why? What's the idea? What are the ideas, plural, behind it? And then finally, what are those solutions, those skill sets that I bring to bear to solve those problems? You find those, then it becomes easy to go back to our mutual friend, Clay Hebert, to summarize that red thread. And so I can, you know, the way that I summarize what I do, as I say, I help people find and speak about the power of their ideas. And that's it. because for me, it's about finding, it's about amplifying that power. And it's about using speech to do it, talking or messaging to do it, even if it's written, because I found that is the fastest path towards change. And that, by the way, was taught to me by Weight Watchers. The fastest path to fate. Yeah. The fact, you know what, just talk to somebody. That's the easiest way to get something to happen.
Wow. So I'm curious, is this something that can be applied to both our personal and professional lives? And I'm more interested in how it applies in our personal lives, actually, because the professional part I get, having done a little bit of work with you.
Yeah, personally, absolutely. So I said at the beginning that my life's work, I think, was a giant attempt to explain my own life. but where it's helpful is that here's what happens when you identify these core pieces of your red thread. This is the most important thing, I think, when it comes to understanding this, that you have this red thread shows up in different ways. You can wrap it around things differently. And so, Clay Bear, our mutual friend, has his perfect introduction, which is usually 6 or 7 words of how you describe yourself. And I always feel like I always feel bad because I'm like, I've got 8. But that actually comes from understanding this red thread. And here's what I mean. If you have your red thread, you understand, okay, I'm always looking for these kinds of problems and I bring these solutions to bear because of this. It becomes very easy in any given situation for you to say, okay, how can I describe myself most powerfully for the situation I'm in right now? So if I'm talking to potential speakers who say, well, what do you do? I say, I help you figure out what your next big idea should be, because that's what's going to be relevant to them. If I'm talking to a broad group of marketers, I can say, I help people and organizations find and tell their story, because that's what marketing is going to want to do. But it's still rooted in the same thing. I'm just able to wrap those things differently around each other. I mean, if I'm feeling metaphorical, I can say I'm a map maker for meaning. I help people turn energy into power. They're all the same thing. What it means, though, is that I can have this really strong, stable base. Anybody can have this really strong, stable understanding of why, you know, what you do and why and how, all linked together. And that it's flexible enough for you to be able to make the most of that red thread in any situation that you're in. So I find that it's incredibly useful when you are in a couple situations. One where people say, well, you know, oh, tell me about yourself. That's one where instantly you can say, okay, given the other things, what's the best way for me to describe my red thread to somebody in this moment? I think it's very helpful when you are trying to figure out, okay, I've been presented a new situation. Here's this new thing. I saw this come to bear with the election that happened in the fall, where I saw a lot of cause shaming, what I would call cause shaming around people. We're like, well, you're not doing enough, whatever side you're on, you know, you're not supporting enough, or you're not calling enough, or you're not protesting enough, you're not doing it. But what it allows people to do is say, well, wait a minute. I'm really good at helping people figure out, if I'm talking about myself, helping people figure out what's the most powerful way to talk about what they're trying to do. So, and I'm not a caller. That's not where my red thread lies. But I can help people be more powerful in what they say when they do call. And so it helps you in this moment where you're like, how do I handle this situation? Somebody's just dropped a project on my desk, to say, okay, if I'm using my own, I can say, well, it helps me focus my attention more quickly. Where are the gaps in energy here? Where is the energy? Why isn't it being maximized? How can we sustain it? What's the fastest way to get that power articulated? Where's the most useful way to do it? What's going to be the technique or the approach that I can give to this particular company or person or environment in order to figure that out? And so the red thread really comes down to giving you a clean, clear sense of the filter that you use to make meaning of the world. And the reason why that's so important is that meaning drives change. If you want to understand how to manage the change that you're facing, or how to create it, or even just how to talk about it, you have to understand what it means first. You have to understand what it means to you, and you have to understand what it's going to mean potentially to other people. And what's fascinating about this universal pattern of the red thread and how we listen for this mad lib of meaning is that if you can explain what something means to you using those same components, then you get to transfer that meaning from one person to the other with the little loss of meaning of energy, back to my metaphor, as possible. And I think that's a really powerful tool for everyone to have.
Wow. I can see now why Clay recommended you. This has been mind-blowingly cool.
One
of my favorite conversations I've had over the course of last year. This has really, really been insightful and powerful. So I have one final question, which is how we finish all our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Consonance is the word that I would come to. So consonance is not like ABCD. Consonance is the opposite of dissonance. So dissonance is, we know it, we can feel it. When something doesn't sound right, doesn't feel right, it's both a physical property and when you can see, when you can feel. And consonance is the exact opposite. And it's best illustrated by a physics. So one thing I never mentioned was that I kind of forgot to study science. I love science. So working at the medical school was amazing. But there's this thing that happens with two tuning forks. And if you have a tuning fork, metal Y that's tuned to a certain note, if you hit it, it makes a sound. And it's one you can't really hear unless you put on something that resonates. And a lot of times when people think about how do I connect, how do I be unmistakable with somebody, they're like, I just need to figure out, I need to find the right box for me to stick my tuning fork on. And I say, no, you're missing half of the picture there. Because that combination of tuning fork and box, that's just you. You have to find something that resonates really strongly for yourself. You have to find the right way for something to really come through for you. And then there's another tuning fork. There's another box. And that's the people that you're talking to. But there's this amazing thing that happens when if you were to hit that first tuning fork, yours, and it sounds a note, if those two tuning forks are perfectly in tune with each other, and let's say like my tuning fork is tuned to A and your tuning fork is tuned to A, if I hit mine and then stop it, yours rings the same note. It's amazing. You can look it up. It's sympathetic frequency. It's the same thing that makes that thing in your car rattle only when you hit a certain speed, which is annoying then, but this idea of consonance, of being perfectly in tune with who you are, how you articulate to the world, and having who you are and what you say also be tuned to the people that you're talking to, when you see that, that's unmistakable. And the best way to get there quickly is to understand that red thread, because it is who you are. It is how you make meaning of the world. And because it also follows the pattern of how other people make meaning, it's the fastest, easiest way for you to get what your note over to them. So consonance is what makes people unmistakable.
Well, that has to be one of my favorite answers I've ever heard to that question. And I think it makes for a fitting end to our conversation. Where can people learn more about you?
It's all at tamsinwebster.com. I'm the only one, so it's easy.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.